Okay, you're sitting comfortably, then I'll begin. That dates me, doesn't it? So this is the third night of the present series of rambles, and we're rambling around consciousness again, and which we're doing all the time, of course. And this time I'm taking as my text a saying from the Anguttara Nikaya of the Pali Canon. This mind is luminous, shining, radiant, but it is defiled by adventitious defilements. Adventitious meaning added to it, that are not native to it, but that are piled on top of it, so to speak. And the Buddha says that if you don't know this, if you don't know this as it really is, then you can't really make mental progress. You can't develop your mind. If you do know it, then there will be mental development for you. So we're trying to illumine what this means. This mind is luminous, but it is defiled by adventitious defilements. So yesterday I explored a model that derives from the Yogacara school or tradition of Buddhism, found in the Mahayana tradition, that is the, with the Madhyamaka, is the central philosophy of Buddhism. I won't recapitulate everything that I said yesterday, but what I will say today will implicitly recapitulate it, and I think that if you weren't here yesterday, you'll probably get some finger holds on what I'm talking about. So what I'm going to be doing today is looking again at the model that I presented yesterday, which is first of all a spatial model of what the mind is, and then a temporal model, a dynamic temporal model. And what I'm going to especially move on to is discussing how we get rid of those defilements according to that model. What I've done so far is establish the way in which the mind is constructed according to the Yogacara school, and now I'm going to show how the defilements that become constructed on that basis are eliminated. So first of all, I'm going to recur to the spatial model. So as I've stressed, I hope sufficiently, mind, according to all Buddhist schools, is not a thing. There is no such thing as mind. Mind is the knower. Mind is the, as it were, pure subjectivity that illumines the world. And it cannot itself be made an object of knowledge, of direct knowledge. We can think about it, we can speculate about it, but we cannot directly perceive it, we cannot directly know it, because it is the knower. The eye cannot see itself, and so on. And it's dynamic, it's not a static thing. When we think about mind, we have to use the structures of our language, which reduce everything to substantives, to objects of experience. So even the knower of experience, we reduce to an object in experience. We reduce mind to the world of tables and chairs and so forth, if you see what I mean. Which it's only we can do metaphorically. It's not actually like that. Mind we can never see, because it's mind that sees, mind that knows. And it's even more, you could say, it's not to be defined as static. It's not that we've got a mind that sees things, it's that in every moment a fresh mind arises. That's the way it's put in Buddhist psychology. The mind arises fresh and new each moment. So if we want to understand a little bit better how this works, we can look at it in a static way. We can look at it, as it were, within space. We can think of the mind spatially. It's only a metaphor. The mind is only to be approached through metaphors, so we must be very careful that we don't get bitten in the backside by the metaphor. Metaphors are very useful, but if we take them too literally, they reverse themselves on us, if you see what I mean, and lead us into a false understanding. So we can examine the mind as if it was distributed in space. What we'll then go on to is to look at the mind as it develops in time. So we looked at three levels to the mind, what are known as the three evolutions of mind in the Yogacara philosophy. Evolutions in the neutral sense of one arising out of the other, not as a development in the sense of a higher value. So the most immediate, most obvious level of the mind is the mind as the senses, sense consciousness, sense awareness. That this is the level of mind that we most identify with our mental functioning. We're aware of the world around us. According to Buddhist thought, each organ, each faculty of sensing has its own consciousness. But this is just a metaphor. They're not actually distinct things. So when we see, we're seeing with the eye consciousness. When we smell, we're smelling with the smell consciousness, and so on. Don't take the idea of six consciousnesses too literally. The six sort of aspects of the way in which mind works. So generally, our basic consciousness, which we're all involved in right now, is the discrimination of a world of sense objects. Through the senses, all combined and analysed and named through the common sense, the sixth sense, the mind sense, which organises the data of our sensory experience into an intelligible whole. That is this level of consciousness. Below that, there's eye consciousness, as I've called it, which in Sanskrit is manas. It's got another name I'll come on to in a moment. And this is the sense underneath that, which we're only dimly aware of I. I am having this experience. I see, I smell, I taste. It's slightly below the level of our immediate awareness, but it enters into every moment of awareness. Do you see what I mean? We're not directly, usually, aware of it taking place. As I mentioned yesterday, we're most likely to be aware of it when something disrupts it. I cited the example yesterday of going to a party. You may have a different experience of parties to me, but in a party you have this sort of... You have to construct yourself in relation to the people who are there. It's certainly when you're only 17 or 18. There's a busy business of trying to sort of give yourself an identity in relation to the people who are there. Actually, we're doing that all the time. All the time there's an underground story going on about who I am. And there's a deeper aspect of awareness that is engaged in identifying myself. And of course, identifying myself in contradistinction. I am not that. That's not me. I am this. And that is mine. That out there is part of my identity. So this mind is at work all the time under the surface of our sensory awareness. And deeper down, we have this level of that is called in the Yogacara the Alaya Vijnana, the store consciousness, the consciousness that is the underground, even more underground, even unconscious or subconscious layer through which our past experience is mediated, and from which the whole structure of our consciousness emerges. So all of this is present right now. All of us are involved in all three levels. We're all involved in looking. We're all involved in hearing. I hope you're involved in hearing. You're all involved in sensing, you know, kinesthetically, and so on. And also you're all probably involved in distinguishing yourself. You'll find that some things I'm saying impact upon you, and you have some as it were, personal reaction to it. You may feel, I don't know what he's talking about. And that may make you feel, as it were, I don't want to put thoughts into your head. It may make you feel, what an idiot he is, not like me, I'm so clever. Or it may make you feel, what an idiot I am, he's so clever. Take your choice. But we're all the time subtly defining ourselves in relation to what's going on, and at a level that we're usually not able to make very conscious. And you usually become conscious of it when there's a clash, when a situation arises in which your self-identity is challenged. But there's a function of the mind, a deeper function of the mind, which is constantly trying to construct a self-identity. It's constructive. It's not that there is a self-identity. It's something that it's a sort of desire, an urge, a mind that is questing for identity. And then down below, there's this sort of source, this fountain from which all the mental activity emerges, which patterns the structure of our experience, which delivers us the material we need in order to understand our experience. It's very, very deep down. We're barely able to intuit it. We can intuit that there is a deeper level to the mind, a level at which we're not conscious. We sort of see, a bit like shining a torch down into a deep cavern. The torch light spreads so far, and then you're aware of the darkness beyond with strange shapes looming within it. So it's like that. There's a layer beneath the conscious mind, which is intimately connected with the conscious mind, but which is not possible to make conscious. Now, each of these layers in the mind has a different ethical and cognitive significance. And this is very important for our examination of the mind's luminosity. So the layer of consciousness, which is our general recognition of consciousness, what we usually think of as being awake or aware, this sensory consciousness with its formulated world, its constructed world, interpreted world, this is ethically significant because it's within that world that we make ethical decisions. We can act, in Buddhist terms, skillfully or unskillfully. Our skillful or unskillful actions arise within the context of the world that we construct out of our sensory intuitions, the information that the senses deliver to us, and the patterns that emerge from deep within us. This synthesis of these inner patterns and these outer sensory information, intuitions. And it's in that world that we act. We have desires to include, to incorporate into our identity elements of the world around us. We have desires to reject elements of the world from our identity, which we believe threaten us or undermine us or challenge us. And we have another clever tactic. We narrow our consciousness down to what we think will not threaten us. This is what ignorance is in this context. Ignorance is the refusal to see. It's not having been informed. It's refusing to see. It's a bit like if I'm talking to you and I suddenly notice that half the audience is asleep. What I shall simply do is carry on talking as if there was nothing going on. If you see what I mean, that would be the tactic that I wouldn't do that, of course. But one might do that because, you know, you're sort of on the stage and giving the talk, and even though half the audience is asleep and the other half is on the verge, you just carry on relentlessly and sort of pretend it's not happening. I've seen that happen many a time on a stage. Never done it, of course. But you deliberately ignore what threatens you or makes you feel uncomfortable. It's one of the most effective existential tactics that we have. It's what makes it possible for people to live next door to people in appalling poverty and ignore them. So it's a mental tactic for closing off. We actually all live in next door to people in appalling poverty somewhere or other in the world. This is the ethical level of the mind, the level at which the mind can be skillful or unskillful, where our ethical choices are made within this constructed world of the senses, not necessarily of the physical senses, it can be a visionary world as well, but within the world of the senses, we make ethical decisions. This level of the mind is also susceptible to ignorance. It's susceptible to ignorance because, of course, it's based usually on what goes deeper, what I've called here the manas. But within that realm of the senses, we misinterpret, or interpret correctly, what is going on. We interpret the world as being literally out there. We think that what we're perceiving are not representations based upon the synthesis of sensory data and our own inner patterns. We interpret it as literally out there. And we interpret ourselves as being located in that world as an object placed within a box, the world is a sort of stable arena into which we are placed. This, the Yogacara argues, we have no basis for deciding. So we misinterpret the world in that way. We think of it as a standing independent of our consciousness as we see it, and we also interpret ourselves as stable, fixed, real selves within that fixed world outside us. That is Buddhism. In Buddhism, ignorance defined. It's misinterpreting the nature of our experience, interpreting it in terms of a fixed self who has the experience, and a fixed world which we have as experience. So this level of the mind is susceptible to ignorance and to unskillfulness. Well, because it's susceptible to ignorance, it's susceptible to unskillfulness, if you see what I mean. Because we misinterpret the world, we misinterpret what will grant us happiness within this world. And we try to seize on to elements outside us, believing that they can be a permanent source of happiness, or we push away elements within our constructed world, which we believe the absence of which will protect our happiness and our identity. And we ignore what's uncomfortable and believe that by doing that, we'll be okay, to put it very simply. So the sense consciousness level is the defiled level. It's the defiled level ethically, and it's cognitively obscured in the technical language. It doesn't see things clearly. It's a misinterpretation. I'm sorry to say, brothers and sisters, this is what the Buddha says about all of us. Well, I presume all of us. That he said, as madmen, sleepwalkers and drunkards. We're misunderstanding. You see somebody very drunk talking to a lamppost, extremely intelligently. We're all doing that, metaphorically speaking. So yes, this level is where defilement most properly takes place. So when we're talking about the mind being luminous but defiled by adventitious defilement, this is where advent takes place. The defilements are enter at this point. At least the ethical defilements enter at this point, and obscure the mind's natural radiance and the mind's natural luminosity. The lower level, beneath that, the level of manas, is of course the source of the obscurity, because it's at this level that we mistake our experience. We take it wrongly. We seize upon the external element, what appears externally, and think of it as out there, fixed, independent, real, ultimately real. And we seize upon the inner dimension, the perceiving dimension, and conceive of that as I standing independent of the existential situation, real, permanent, ultimate. This is where that takes place. That's the obscuration on the basis of which the ethical defilements take place. Got it? So at this level, we misunderstand. We can't at that level do anything, so to speak. It's a level of pure cognition. Although when we say cognition, we shouldn't think of, the sort of thinking, merely thinking. It's more like an emotio-cognitive complex. The sense of self is as much emotional as cognitive. And in fact, it's sort of almost deeper than both those. It's a very strong sense of attachment. In fact, the Yogacara speaks of this level as having four characteristics. It's, I'm sure I can remember them. Don't prompt me. It's atmasneha, which means the infatuation with self. Sounds very narcissistic. This complete absorption in self. This everything referred back to I. It's atmamana, which means pride in self. We think we are number one. We think the world revolves around us. So it's the egocentric factor, as it were. There's a strong, immediate, emotional clinging. And then there are the two more slightly cognitive dimensions to it. There's atma-moha, which means ignorance about self. We refuse to notice the truth of things as it's constantly presented to us. So, for instance, we fail to recognize that we're going to die and that this puts a big challenge on what it is to be alive. We fail to notice that. We fail to notice it by shutting it out. And it's a mechanism that's deep inside us to protect ourselves by ignoring what threatens. And then accompanying that is atma-drishti, which means views about self. So it's not just that we refuse to recognize what undermines our sense of self. We've actually got ideas about who we are, which at the higher level manifest in all sorts of theories about who we are. But at this level, it's more instinctive, a deeply imbued decision about what we are, but below the level of conscious ratiocination. So do you see what I mean? This level of the mind is an automatic, deep attachment to self with a strong constructive function, which is constantly constructing self. It's not a thing that's there. It's a process of constantly constructing, reconstructing. At this level, it's the urge to do that. So this is where ignorance comes in. If you could say that at the level of sense consciousness, ethical, skillful and unskillful enter in. At the level of manas, ignorance steps in. So ignorance is acquired. It's added. It is added at this level. At the level of store consciousness, there is neither ethical nor ethical defilement nor cognitive obscuration. The alia is, as it were, innocent. It's quite amazing, isn't it, that when you think about it, that from this point of view, there's a level of our mind that is completely ignorant, completely innocent. prejudices die hard, don't they? There's a layer of our minds. Every moment, right now, there's a layer of the mind that's innocent. That's innocent ethically, and that's not fooled, not taken in, not deceived. The deception comes in at the next level, at the level of the construction of self. And the defilement, the ethical defilement, comes in at the level of the construction of the world in terms of a sensory picture, so to speak. So this is very important. This is where the luminosity of the mind begins to come in. The Alia, if you like, is the mind still luminous. Well, see, it's not quite straightforward because, of course, although it's luminous, it's the source from which all the other levels of the mind come in. We'll see that in the dynamic model. But itself, this level of the mind is innocent and, as it were, pure, you could almost say. And its characteristic is a sort of shining, a sort of brilliance. But as we construct the world on the basis of self-identity, we dim the world, we limit the world, we confine it. We break it up, we narrow it down. But at the level of the Alia, as it emerges immediately in every moment, it's quite pure, it's quite luminous. It, you know, luminosity is here used as a metaphor because we have no other choice, we have no other words to talk about it. But it's a very good metaphor because it does have something of that shining quality, may even be experienced as intense light. When you are sort of forced into it. And you get moments, I've already referred to this, you get moments when mind does, you get a glimpse of it. Of course, I mentioned a sickness. I mentioned coming round from a swoon, as if before the whole edifice is properly got underway, properly constructed, there's a sense of sort of purity and openness, even happiness, contentment and lack of disturbance. I won't tell you my fainting stories again. Sometimes when you wake up in the morning, somebody mentioned anaesthetics. There are various situations in which, for a while, the added superstructure is suspended. It's not completely suspended, of course, because you couldn't sort of bring anything from it otherwise, but there's a moment during which you just experience this very expansive, very free, very natural, very relaxed, radiant awareness, which can be even, yes, blissful, very, very happy, very contented. It's quite strange in some strange situations where, I've heard of people in very bad accidents actually experiencing a tremendous sense of sort of release and relaxation. According to Buddhist tradition, particularly the Tibetan tradition, which charts what happens after death in some detail, this is what happens after death. To begin with, you experience the complete suspension of the upper levels of the mind, to use the spatial metaphor, and what you experience is just this luminous mind, this luminosity, which doesn't seem to come from anywhere, it's not yours, it's not somebody else's, it's just luminosity. Then, of course, construction starts to come in again because, we'll see why. So this layer of the mind is there all the time, but immediately succeeded by constructions that are placed upon it. There's very, very important implications for us because what it implies is that, Sangharakshita speaks of faith being innate, doubt acquired. Doubt is sort of added on, but faith is natural to us, to put it in terms of faith. That purity is something that we already have in a certain sense. You have to be careful how you understand this and not get too metaphysical about it. You haven't really got it, but there's a layer of your mind that is in itself naturally pure. But the defilements, the unethical conduct, are added on top of it. So that has a tremendous implication for what it is that we're doing. What's implied is that we're trying to get rid of the defilements so that the luminosity can shine forth. So we're not trying to make something. We're not trying to sort of build a bonfire or turn on a light or something like that. We're trying to discover what actually is, if we would only let it be. And this has tremendous implications for what we're doing in a place like this, that a lot of our work is creating the conditions under which we can get rid of the obscurations that hide from us this natural radiance of the mind. According to Buddhist tradition, we get a strong experience of this radiance when we enter deep meditation. The jhanas are spoken of as pabasarang, which is the word used for luminosity, pabasarang idang chittang. Luminous is this mind. So samadhi, jhana, is luminous. When we enter the states of deep meditation, short of enlightenment itself, we have a temporary experience of that luminosity shining forth. We're suspending these, or rather we're aligning these with that luminosity. It's a bit as if we're sort of aligning them so that the light can shine up through them rather than obscuring it. Yeah. So in various situations, that luminosity does shine forth. In situations of, for instance, intense aesthetic enjoyment, you get some sense of the world as shining. In intense communication, you may not experience it as light, so to speak, but you get a sense of something absolutely natural and unforced, just flowering. You may just get it quite spontaneously. I always used to love dipping into William James' varieties of religious experience. There's some wonderful moments. There's a wonderful description of a Yorkshire policeman who at the end of his day's beat would walk across the Yorkshire moors, and there's a very intense description of a great joy, great happiness, completely spontaneously welling up within him. So you can imagine this very down-to-earth, canny Yorkshire plod in bliss as he walks over the moors. I don't know what he told his sergeant, but... so it doesn't have to be anything very, you know, lofty or sophisticated or whatever. It's natural, because it's happening all the time. The first moment of every moment of consciousness, or the first aspect of every moment of consciousness, is this luminous alaya. So I hope that's clear. This model, it gives us a quite important insight into the work that we've got to do. We've got to, first of all, deal with the level of ethical defilement. Ethical defilement prevents us from seeing that luminosity. So we deal with that through sila, through ethical conduct. Through ethical conduct, we align the world of the senses, our sense consciousness, with that natural radiance and luminosity. We then prepare ourselves to look more deeply by entering into meditation. We try to still the mind. We try to create for a while some real sense of that luminous mind at one level or another, so that we can see clearly what's going on. So that's samadhi. And then we try to look at that I creation, that instinctive seeking after a self-identity. And we try to see through it, to recognize what it is. That's prajna. Huh? So sila, samadhi, prajna slowly remove the defilements. The ethical defilements, the cognitive obscurations, the two veils of klesha and jnaya, klesha varana, jnaya varana. The two veils, a veil is a curtain that obscures, that hides. So there's a curtain of ethical obscuration and unskillful mental states, and then there's a curtain of misunderstanding, of ignorance, and of wrong understanding. So we're trying to part those curtains so that the radiance of the mind naturally flows through. Okay, that's the static model, and in the next few minutes, so I've got to take you through the dynamic model. So, from yesterday, those of you who were here yesterday will remember that the alia is the the condensation of our previous unskillful actions. It's the vipaka, the medium for the vipakas, for the fruits of our previous actions, both skillful and unskillful. So because of those previous actions, unskillful and skillful, it forms a sort of substructure for our minds. It even, according to tradition, determines which realm we will be born into, and how we will be reborn, how we will experience what we're reborn into. And rebirth can be taken in the life-by-life sense or the moment-by-moment sense. So it receives the impressions from our previous actions, karma, skillful and unskillful or neutral, and patterns itself on that basis. And it also receives the impulses of our previous clinging to self, our previous self-seeking, seeking after self. These two forces pattern the alia and begin to emerge as the superstructure we saw yesterday. So the superstructure emerges out of our previous actions through the alia. Because we've got a particular pattern of activity in the past, it forms a particular mental world for us, this world, and its particularity for each of us. And because we've been craving and after self, we've been hunting for self, we've been trying to find an identity, failing and then trying again and failing and trying again. And because that impulse is not yet seen through, is not yet dried up, it emerges through the alia as the manas, which is also known as the klishto mano vijnana, which means the defiled mind consciousness. So this is where the defilement begins to take place. The defilement of the mind's luminosity, the natural radiance, which is still alive in the alia, even though the alia is patterned in accordance with our previous actions and self-clinging, but which the manas obscures. It begins to dampen down that that natural radiance by its quest for I, something that I can identify with, which is the primary force that keeps us going, so to speak, moment by moment, day by day, life by life. This is how it all comes about, how we obscure the natural radiance of the mind under the force of our previous ignorance and clinging and our previous activity, actions. So clearly, we can't just sort of turn round and get back to the alia. We can get, you know, like the exercise we did before this started, we can have some sort of intuition of it, and maybe some of you even had quite a strong experience of that luminosity of the mind. Probably quite a lot didn't really know what it was all about. It's okay. But we can't just go straight back. We can't think, oh yeah, it's luminous, and go back. Because the force coming from the past creates the superstructure of defilement. Do you see what I mean? It's happening because of what we've done before. So we have to work on it, as it were, in advance. This is why I think we must be very careful of these rather superficial teachings you get even in Buddhist and quasi-Buddhist circles, that, you know, it's all about just seeing. But ultimately it is about just seeing. But you can't just see, because you're on a rocket ship going at 1,000 miles an hour and everything's just a blur. all around you, or because you're so deep in the whatever that you can't see out your glasses, they're dirty. You have to change the environment. Huh? And if you're to really see down to that luminosity, if you're really to allow that luminosity to shine, you have to change the environment. And you can't go directly down to the alia. You have to work in advance to change how it works in the future. So you work through Shila. That's basic. If you're not acting skillfully, well, the alia will be patterned by your unskillful action, which will take you away from that luminosity. You'll have to fight through the sort of coarse, thick veils of your own karma vipaka, the fruits of your own actions. And if you haven't begun to work to sort of loosen up your self-sense, you will not be able even to think that you have no permanent existence. You'll be terrified. You'll be scared out of your wits, almost. Well, you'll be scared into a sort of an extraordinariness. So we have to work to change the way in which the mind emerges into the alia, as the alia, first of all, and then the whole superstructure that's erected on top of that. We have to work on it now for the future. Even moment by moment, we have to be working on it now for the next moment, for the moments that come. We have to work at Shila. We have to be working to make our actions more skillful. We have to be working at samadhi, at mental development, to try to make our mental activity skillful, and try to make our mental activity more and more plastic, more and more pliable, more and more adaptable, less fixed, less rigid. And we have to be working at prajna, which means working to understand what the real nature of things is. And as we do that, the alia will emerge with a less fixed sort of pattern. And it will manifest in the manas, of course, for quite a long time, and the six senses, but they'll be much more fluid, much more plastic. So that when we're in relationship to other people, we'll be less determined to defend I. We'll be less insistent on defending I. When things happen that are unexpected and that are contrary to our wishes, we'll be able to roll with them more readily. And we'll be able to function more skillfully in relation to the world around us. Because the whole system is more plastic, to put it that way. More pliable, more adaptable, more fresh. And much looser, so we're able to take in more that's from outside. We'll be able to let that radiance fill us. Often that radiance can be overwhelming and terrifying. Descriptions in the Book of the Dead and so forth describe this radiance as the basic radiance of your own mind as overwhelming and terrifying to those who have no affinity for it. So as the alia becomes more plastic because of the actions that you've done in the past and the work you've done to free up your understanding, it's better able to take things in, better able to let go, better able to see what's there. And that is a lot of our basic practice. Is simply changing the structure of our mind as it emerges moment by moment. We're working so that in the future, maybe next moment, maybe tomorrow, maybe next year, where our minds are going to be able to take things in more readily, and we're going to be able to act more skillfully in relation to the world. We'll feel more in tune with it, in more in harmony with it, so we won't react so strongly. We won't defend ourselves. We'll feel more of an affinity with what's around us. And we'll increasingly experience moments of intense luminosity. We'll experience moments when the light breaks through, you could say. When we experience, for instance, intense beauty. Maybe in nature. You see, you know, the classic beautiful sunset with all the wonderful colours. Where I live in Wales, the sun sets behind a mountain just 2 miles away. And often as the sun sinks behind the mountain, you get a beautiful contrast of the sort of pale purples and mauves of the mountain, and rays of golden and orange light shining up from behind the mountain. Intensely beautiful. As you become more attuned to that inner luminosity, you're able to relate to what outside, as it were, embodies that. So you respond to beauty in the environment, in nature. You respond to beauty in other human beings. Not necessarily because they are especially beautiful of form, but you can see in them a beauty of spirit, if you like, of mind, even of heart, and so on. You respond to beauty in art, which represents in the objective world something that is beyond the objective world, to put it that way. So you'll find that as you work to change the current, the way in which the alaya emerges, therefore the degree to which the radiance is able to penetrate up into the superstructure of your mind, you'll find yourself responding more and more to beauty, to friendship, to communication, to truth, to all these ultimate values. You'll find yourself just naturally responding to them, not thinking about it, just responding. Because, as it were, they represent externally, that the way they'll appear to you externally, what you're increasingly experiencing internally. You'll experience a sort of an accord between an outer circumstances, an outer circumstance, and an inner sense. And eventually, according to the Yogacara, what takes place is a turning about. I'm not going to go into this very deeply. I'm not going to pursue the metaphor as taken in the Yogacara because time is running out. But a turning about in the deepest seat of consciousness. That's the deep seat of consciousness, the alaya. That is the deep seat of consciousness. What happens is the alaya stops being oriented towards self. It's as if the alaya, the whole structure of the mind changes. It sort of turns inside out or upside down. It becomes completely different. Your mind works in a completely different way. The best way one can think about that, one can talk about that, is in terms of values that we all know, but that we can imagine becoming completely natural and spontaneous. For instance, metta. Probably everybody here has done the metta bhavana, struggled to bring some metta, some well-wishing to life. When the turning about in the deepest seat of consciousness takes place, metta, it just shines out. You could even talk of that luminosity as much as metta, as maitri, as love, as luminosity. It just shines out. You don't have to try. It's sort of what your mind is. Your mind is loving and compassionate and so forth. We know that the importance of truth, of clarifying what really is. And we know that through intense reflection, we can arrive at moments of real understanding, a real recognition. Well, you imagine when that turning about in the deepest seat of consciousness takes place, that's spontaneous. You naturally see all the time things as they are. You don't have to try. Well, after all, that's how things are. So you just look, you see. You don't have to try to discover beauty. You don't have to sort of work to discover beauty. You see beauty in everything. Of course, not necessarily at the mundane sensory level, as it were. But you see, even in ugliness, behind the ugliness, something intensely beautiful. It's quite hard to discuss or talk about. You could see the struggle of life to manifest itself, the struggle of that luminosity to manifest itself in the world all around us. And you can respond to that deeply. Even, you know, you can get some intuition of this when sometimes you can see people behaving extremely badly, even perhaps evilly. But somehow or other you can still see within them, deep within them, a sort of beauty. Not in their action. You're not at all justifying or ignoring the unethical and even evil of their action. But you're seeing that that is not ultimately what they are. You can see within them that even their evil comes out of a misplaced attempt to resolve the riddle of life. You can see that life pressing up within them. And so on. The Yogacara talks of what happens when the turning about takes place in terms of the mandala of the five Buddhas. I left myself no time to go into this, but just as a reference for all of you who are aware of this, it talks of the mind after the turning about has taken place no longer being structured in these terms. There's no longer a manas. In a sense, there's no longer the six sense consciousnesses. They don't function in that way. Of course, you still see things, you still are able to enter into conversation, you're still able to get up in the morning and have breakfast. But you no longer interpret it all on the basis of I, and you no longer interpret your everyday experience in terms of a structure of self and other. And the mandala of the five Buddhas is an attempt to sort of express in imaginative terms what that mind is like. It's, for instance, it has, well, five wisdoms, it said, the mirror-like wisdom. It just sees, just as a mirror accurately, exactly reflects whatever is placed before it, the mind which has turned about simply sees. It can't be fooled, it can't be taken in, can't be deluded. It sees what's there. But it's not a cold seeing. That mind also has the wisdom of equality or the wisdom of sameness. It sees in everything that unique quality of openness, even of beauty. It sees it in everything, naturally, spontaneously. It doesn't see everything as homogeneous. It sees everything uniquely, everything distinctly. It has the discriminating wisdom. Because to love, you need to discriminate. You know, if love is sort of indiscriminate, it's not really love. If you're not responding positively, if you're not responding to the individual, it's not really love, if you see what I mean. It's just a general wishy-washy loviness. But love properly responds to particulars. Yes, it has the discriminating wisdom, but it's not just discriminating. It's not just seeing. It's not just seeing things clearly. Not just seeing the ultimate beauty in things. Not just seeing the uniqueness of things and responding with love to that. It's creative. That mind spontaneously acts to bring about. The shining forth of that luminosity in all things. The individual who's turned about in every situation finds the way forward, finds the way out, finds the way up, if you see what I mean. And lastly, the all accomplishing wisdom. That mind has the wisdom of the sphere of the truth. It's not that with that wisdom you sort of exit this world and enter another world. Your world, this world, is suffused with the truth, is expressive of the ultimate truth, is underlain by the powerful principle of the Dharma. So the turning about sort of completely eliminates this old structure, or turns this old structure into a quite new structure of functioning, which we get as we begin to work upon the alaya through our actions, through our meditative work, through our attempt to understand. It gradually gets more and more intuitions, more and more glimpses of this inner luminosity, this inner radiance, which is natural to us, and that we don't have to create or artificially construct. We have to discover within us through our effort, intense effort, prolonged and intense effort, believe me, prolonged effort to change the current. So I hope this explains the structure of our minds a little, at least in the context of our Dhamma practice. This is not an abnormal psychology, it's a Dhamma psychology. It's a psychology which explains how we gain freedom, how we gain liberation, how we discover that luminosity of the mind. There's a lot that is open to misinterpretation. And since we've got the manas, we'll naturally try to find an misinterpretation. I've probably even expressed a few in my own exposition. But if we can sort of get to grips with this model, I think it really does help us to see what we're trying to do, and perhaps gives us a lot of confidence that fundamentally we're all right. Unfortunately, after the fundamental, that's where the problem comes, and there's quite a big problem too. But fundamentally, we're okay. And it's a question of relaxing and sort of allowing ourselves come back to what we ultimately are. This mind is luminous, but it is defiled by adventitious defilements. If we don't know this as it is, then we can't develop mentally. If we do know this as it is, then there is mental development for us. Thank you.